Racing Australia, the official podcast of the Australian Police Journal.
Hello and welcome to Policing Australia. I'm Jason Burns, an assistant editor at the Australian Police Journal. In a short while, I'll speak with a detective sergeant from the Northern Territory Police about a brutal double homicide which occurred near Darwin in 2004. The police response to the murders was a short but intense investigation, during which time the two offenders fled to Queensland, only to be located and arrested by local police, then extradited back to Darwin to stand trial. First, though, I'm joined by APJ editor Pat Perroz to discuss the latest edition of the APJ, which has just been published and is available either in hard copy or online for subscribers at www.apjl.com.au. G'day, Pat. How are you?
Good, mate. Good as you can be in lockdown.
Indeed.
Unfortunately.
We have some great news, though, this month. It's the 75th anniversary of the APJ, and we've made the September 2021 issue an anniversary edition.
Yeah, we've gone bigger than normal just to celebrate the 75th anniversary, as you say. First one was October 1946, so September 2021 marks the actual full 75-year anniversary. We've tried to include a sample of articles that represent not only all of the jurisdictions, the states and territories, but also the time period. So we've got, you know, an article from the very first edition of 1946. The most recent article we've published is, I think it was 2016. So it covers the whole gamut of what policing has done over the years. And I think it'll show readers how much the APJ, as well as policing, has evolved in that time. That was the plan anyway.
You're right, but in some regards, policing hasn't changed that much. As shown in the article you referenced from the very first issue of the APJ in 1946, that article is about the types of people police come into contact with in the front counters of police stations.
Yeah, it was really quite interesting. That one's called Our Guests. It was written by a Queensland officer attached to the CIB up there in Brisbane back in 1946, and it was making his observations about the type of people that police encounter at any inquiry counter in any police station. Obviously, he was talking about Brisbane, but anyone who reads that who's been in the police in any way, shape or form will recognise the different categories of people that this fellow refers to, about when they come to police for assistance, the different sort of categories that you can put them in. And he talks about it, how it's, in his way, he sees it as a bit of entertainment in terms of that for the police who are in the counters, because they have to deal with all of these things, obviously in a very humane, polite way. But as a former colleague of mine used to say, and it really relates to this article, I think, this fellow used to say, being in the cops, you've got front row seats to the best show on earth. And I think that sort of really does relate to this fellow's article from 1946. So I think when people read it, they'll really see that a lot of things have changed, but the people that we deal with in many ways still come to the police for much the same reasons as they have done for a long time.
You've mentioned we have articles from each of the eight policing jurisdictions in Australia. What was our thinking in terms about selecting content for the anniversary issue?
As I said earlier, we wanted to make sure we represent, as the Australian Police Journal does, represents all of the policing agencies in Australia, so all the states and territories. So each of those states and territories has at least two articles in the 75th edition. And then what we looked at was trying to get a cross-section of all the different things that the police might get involved in. So we've got things in relation to underwater rescues, riots, forensic examinations, criminal investigations, obviously, and then looking at the types of criminal investigations that police get involved in and the serious nature of the incidents that police over time have had to deal with.
What are some of the articles that stand out to you, Pat?
For the purpose of the podcast, I've tried to pick a couple that I think sort of show that breadth and the depth of the things that police do. One of them is from South Australia. It was an incident that happened in 1973, and it's called The Shaft. The Shaft is the name given to a sinkhole on a rural property. And when I say sinkhole, this sinkhole, I'm not sure of the actual depth of it, because I don't think any divers actually reached the bottom of it. But in the article, it talks about depths of 250 to 280 feet, which whilst I'm no diver, I know that that's a long way down. And on this occasion, back in 1973, eight friends went deep water diving in this magnificent underground subterranean lake. And unfortunately, only four of them came back. So it was interesting to me for this article because, one, it's the underwater rescue thing, which is not something that you normally associate with everyday policing, but it's certainly something that had to be done. And it happened in May of 1973, this particular incident. The first body wasn't recovered until January of 1974, and the last body was recovered in April 1974. So almost 12 months later, the fourth of the four bodies was retrieved by the police. So whilst this operation wasn't ongoing every day, there were a whole range of things that the police involved in the South Australian Police Forces, I think it was called the Underwater Recovery Squad at the time, probably got a new name these days.
The divers are now part of the Special Tactics and Rescue Unit, or STAR.
They had to go away and actually do some training with the Australian Navy, get new equipment, and then do extra training in relation to being able to cope with the pressures of associated with deep water diving. One of the terms they referred to was nitrogen narcosis, which I'd heard a little bit about it, but it's interesting to read it, where it can have an intoxicating effect on people who are doing deep diving. And whilst I don't think anyone knows the answers on this one of the theories put forward is that the four people who were lost may have suffered from that and got disoriented and couldn't make their way back to the surface. And the vast nature of this underground lake was such that when the divers first got there, the bodies just couldn't be located despite their best efforts. That's why it took so long, that the bodies moved around and floated and got stuck under ledges. And just ultimately it took the persistence and the determination of these rescue divers to hang in there and keep going till they were able to retrieve these bodies.
What struck me reading the article, as you say, was the persistence on the part of police. They had to get extra training and new equipment, and there weren't too many other people in Australia who had the capability and qualifications at the time. The episode also had some far-reaching impacts on the broader diving community in terms of the standards and practices in sinkhole diving, and it seems to be a case which is still cited in contemporary diver training.
Oh, I can imagine it would be. It's obviously tragedy first and foremost, but as you say, the learnings that must have come out of something like that would be not just for the rescuers, but for everyone who's involved in those dives for recreation. I think one of the comments that the author wrote in it, he finishes towards the end of the article, if I could just read it to you. He made the comment that so long as the human race endures and walks hand in hand with the goddess Curiosity, this story will have many sequels. And I just thought that was a wonderful way to put it, that, well, that was a tragedy, but you're always going to have people out there pushing limits and doing exploring. And we've all seen over the years that police are involved in rescue after rescue every year purely because of accidents that happen and when people are exploring things.
Yeah, and the shaft is one of two diving articles in the issue. The other article is about one which occurred off the coast of Victoria at the site of a deliberately sunken wreck of an old military submarine.
Yeah, again, that was even more so where you think you don't associate police rescues with deep water ocean rescues and people diving in submerged submarines. But that was another tragic tale of a husband and wife went diving together, went into a submerged submarine, which had snapped in half when it was sunk. A very popular spot, I understand, for divers. And unfortunately, they got separated while they were down diving. And when the husband resurfaced, his wife wasn't there. And despite efforts from an off-duty police officer at the time, who was another diver in the area, and another gentleman who both risked their own safety to go back down and look for her, again, that lady perished in a submarine and couldn't be found for quite some time. And it took very experienced police divers with specialised equipment that enabled them to go down and stay down longer, pretty much like some of the diving equipment you see on movies, where they had their oxygen and the communication provided to them from the surface. So it wasn't a matter of taking tanks down and looking to do the body retrieval. They actually had to wear their equipment where the oxygen is pumped into the suit that they're wearing so that they could stay down for longer to conduct the thorough search.
Moving from underwater to on land, there is the very sad case in the September issue relating to Operation Tulip, the investigation into the murder of a very young child.
Oh, absolutely. And when you say, Jason, when you say young child, the reason this one stood out for including it was because of the fact that police involved in it were confronted with a situation where it was an infant's body. And when I say an infant's body, the doctor during the post-mortem made the comment, the child lived, in his words, long enough to breathe and expand some portion of the lungs. So he was only talking a couple of minutes that the child was alive for before it was brutally murdered and its body disposed of. And it was only a pet dog one morning was playing with something on a driveway when an innocent, completely innocent family were heading off to school. It was found to be what appeared to be a small infant's leg on their driveway. And from that, obviously horrified, I think it was 12 or 13-year-old girl and her mother rang the police up in Queensland, and they checked it out and unfortunately confirmed that it was. So again, crime scene established, everything secured, but the investigation unfolded. The investigation took several years to work it out, but it was an example of, firstly, the absolute terrible things that innocent civilians and police sometimes are confronted with, and then just the determination in a really complex investigation. Obviously, infant, the deceased, there's really no record of life anywhere. So it was a lot of things that were people could deny things or say it never happened and no one could refute that. The police had to prove every aspect of their case, obviously beyond a reasonable doubt. That's difficult when there's sometimes you're only getting one side of a story. But the police persisted. Now, it took them several years, but they ultimately identified and charged people in relation to what, you know, I look at and go, is this one of the, must be one of the worst crimes that police would have to investigate.
It's a shocking case, but a tremendous example of the type of police work required to get a comprehensive brief of evidence before a court.
100%, but just the determination of the police, the persistence, and obviously they're just the intelligence and their investigation techniques. And that incident happened in 1998, so that's a long time ago. I'm certainly no expert on what the forensic capabilities were back then, but you know, they're obviously a lot better these days. But the investigation, from the early stages, you can tell from reading the article that the detectives who were involved had their suspicions fairly early, but as you know, suspicions don't mean much in terms of proving anything. And they had to build their case and investigate and re-interview people and work with the doctors as an important part of that case. And as I say, eventually, over a period of years, whilst they're no doubt doing all their ongoing jobs, these wonderful detectives have persisted and identified who they thought was the offender and put him before the court.
And that leads into another intriguing article about a more recent example of investigative and forensic work. In this case, it was Tasmania Police who relied on the work of forensic officers and personnel who were able to discover the minuscule remains of a human body on a remote rural property.
As you say, it was a more recent article. It was 2010 this incident happened. It's called The Search for Human Remains. And the reason we selected this one was I think it's a really good practical example of the importance of forensic evidence, particularly the importance of gathering the evidence in a way that it can be used and presented to court and help secure a conviction. This incident related to a missing person case. As a part of a separate investigation in relation to a drug matter, some intelligence was gathered that made police think that possibly the missing person may have been murdered. So inquiries were then initiated in relation to that. A suspect was identified in a potential crime scene through the police investigation. And when I say potential crime scene, we're talking about a 10-acre parcel of land in a rural area. What I found really interesting with this one was that before they even went anywhere near the scene, so at this stage it's very much a covert operation. So before the forensic officers went anywhere near the scene, they got access to aerial photographs, aerial surveillance, maps, contours, as much intelligence as they could, and reviewed all that with all the known information they had about the missing person. And so that before they even got to the scene, they had a fairly good idea of where they were going to prioritise their search. And when you look in a 10-acre property, I'm guessing that prioritising your search is very, very important. This just seemed to me a really good example of forensic officers using that expertise to assist the detectives so that when they did arrive at the scene, they had a plan in place, a really good, thorough plan, and they executed it and gathered a heap of evidence that I can't say ultimately led to the person pleading guilty, but I'm pretty sure that if none of that evidence was available, the person may never have been identified as the offender.
Yeah, I found it to be a very readable and accessible article.
I'm not a forensic person in any way, shape or form, and I read it and could understand, and I think it was written that way so that the generalist police officer could read it or a member of the public could read it and understand the process and the reasons why things were done in a certain way, even down to why certain locations were identified because of soil, the way the soil was, or the plants that were growing there, the contours, fires had been lit or material might have been used to cover a body was identified. But then how the sections were broken up into grids of about 1.5 metre square and a metre deep, and then the soil in those grids, one grid at a time, removed 10 centimetres at a time, and everything was then sieved three times through three different layers of a sieve so that for the thoroughness of identifying a fairly comprehensive list of items that they were looking for that might have been associated with the victim. And they found quite a few of them through this really thorough process of breaking the area down into grids and searching it systematically, logging everything that was found three-dimensionally so that when it was found, they could tell where it was, how deep in that particular grid it was. So from a non-forensic person's reading of it, I can understand how effective it was. I think it's a really interesting read.
Another article in the issue is about an event which only recently had its 25th anniversary, and that was the major riot at Parliament House in Canberra in 1996.
Yes. I think something you know a little bit about yourself, but I've included that one because it's Parliament House, it's obviously important to all of us. And it sort of relates to what's happening across lots of places at the moment with mass gatherings of people in relation to their opposition to a whole range of things. I won't necessarily say they're all COVID related, because I'm sure there's a whole lot of range of other underlying motives behind some of the people gathering, but it just shows that on those occasions when large numbers of people do gather, it presents another unique and challenging obstacle for the police who have to deal with it. The Parliament House one was a little bit different because it wasn't just police. It was certainly the AFP, the Australian Federal Police, were there, but they had parliamentary police and security or protective services and then parliamentary security officers all working side by side. I'm not sure how many people there. It was over 5,000 people is mentioned in the article.
Even to this day, no one really knows exactly how many people were there to protest proposed government workplace reforms. But there's certainly a fair few hundred who tried to force their way into the building.
Yeah, I'm sure it wasn't the whole 5,000 who engage in the behaviour that causes the problem for the police. The sheer fact that they're there emboldens everyone else who wants to play up. And I think on this occasion, it went for over 3 hours, the first pitched battle. And I say that because the way I read it, it was just a non-stop pitch battle where the people who were defending Parliament and, in a sense, therefore defending democracy, were basically had to withdraw on occasions and regroup at the next sort of perimeter to the buildings because they were sort of being outnumbered and overrun. The part I really like it is the way the article, or the way that we've got the article finishing in the journal, is it talks about, in this edition of the journal, talks about that ultimately to regain the initiative, 300 or so AFP protective services officers and security officers again form up, and they actually surged forward. So rather than holding the static line, which they tried to do to protect Parliament House for several hours, they actually surged forward to regain the initiative and conducted what was described as a vigorous offensive. And I think most police would like to hear that ultimately you can hold the line for so long, but sometimes the police, as they did on that occasion, the police and the security officers had to take the offensive to make sure that they could save the day. And that's how the article reads.
That was pretty much it. I still give presentations on this event, having been one of several hundred police involved on the day. It was a really tough experience. A whole range of factors combined to make it a very willing contest between the small group of particularly violent demonstrators and police. Look, I still have some pretty vivid memories of the injured police being put into the ambulances, the shouts and screams echoing through the large halls of Parliament, the then Prime Minister coming out to personally inspect the damage and thank police afterwards, and the next day the riot at Old Parliament House and how we police had to return to confront another group of violent protesters. It was a pretty significant and defining episode for public demonstrations in Canberra in the 1990s. And I think most of society, not just police, stopped and took stock of what occurred.
Yeah, I mean, public order policing has certainly come a long way in the last 25 years. It's obviously a massive issue these days where most organisations have squads ready to go and a lot of people trained in the commands and things like that. But that was just a good example of quite often what happens is most people intending to protest peacefully as they're entitled to do and as they should be allowed to do, and other groups of people basically hijacking it for their own purposes, and then things get out of control. So I know that police will always try and work with lawful protests and things like that, but sometimes they end up like this. And it really was, the way I read it, a pitched battle where the police and security just had to keep withdrawing, regroup, withdraw, regroup, get reinforcements. We talk about public order training. You look at one of the parts of the article where they talk about the motorcycle police were put in the front line because they had helmets. These days, if it's a planned, right, like everyone who's involved in public order policing in a squad would have all of their own personal equipment on issue, kitted up, ready to go. But back in that day, obviously, it was motorcycle helmets were seen as a bit of a protection and they were thrown into the front line because of that.
Very much a different era. Listener, Pat and I haven't talked about this, but I had family members who were outside the building and were part of the overwhelming majority of the peaceful protesters. They were standing not 200 metres away from where I was, and because of the crowds, they genuinely didn't know about the violence. It shows just how easy it is for a relatively small number of people to be able to ruin it for the majority.
Yeah. Fortunately, that's usually the case. So fortunately in one way, unfortunately in another. But I say fortunately in that... It's good that it's not the 5,000 people in the crowd who want to play up, but as you say, but most of the people are there for a lawful, peaceful protest and things got out of hand.
And certainly a small group went there for a fight.
They got it.
It was the last really large-scale violent protest to be held in Canberra. There have been multiple protests since for various reasons, but none have been anywhere near as violent as those from 25 years ago, and that's a good thing.
Let's hope it's another 25 years.
Pat, I see the anniversary issue includes a tribute to Senior Constable David Masters from the Queensland Police Service. He recently was killed in the line of duty.
Yeah, unfortunately, the September edition of the Australia Police Journal traditionally has a mention in relation to fallen officers, mainly because National Police Remembrance Day being held in September, so we like to recognise that fact and honour it. unfortunately, each year there's been someone new that's added to the honour roll in Canberra that the Police Journal just wants to acknowledge their contribution to their police service and their community and show the respect that they deserved. And unfortunately, again this year, there was another officer added to the list.
It's very sad, and we at the APJ certainly honour the ultimate sacrifice made by David Masters and all police who have died in the line of duty. Pat, just before we conclude, is there anything else you wanted to raise?
Very briefly, let people know that what we've done with this edition of the journal is that not all of the articles are reproduced in full, obviously because of just sheer size that it wasn't feasible to put, I think it's about 18 or 19 articles all up in their entirety. So what we've done is taken either an extract from articles, which hopefully will leave the reader at a point where they go, I really want to read the rest of it, and they can go to their website. They can go to our website now due to the process of published issues being added to the website. So they'll be able to go to the website now, Australian Police Journal website, to read the full articles and see all the pictures. They'll get to a point where they're reading your story and they really do want to find out what happened next or how did this finish up. So they'll go to the website and have a look at it. That'll be fantastic for them. So we encourage people to go and do that. One of the articles I just wanted to touch on it was it's also the 25th anniversary of the Port Arthur tragedy. And we've taken a section of an article that was written about that many years ago. But this one looks at the incident from a forensic firearm examiner's viewpoint. And it also shows the interjurisdictional assistance, which sort of goes hand in hand with the APJ, that Victoria sent Special Operations Group police to Tasmania straight away, basically, so that they could be there overnight to assist their colleagues on the ground in Tasmania. New South Wales, the following day, sent crime scene officers and forensic officers. I think it was New South Wales and Victoria also sent pathologists down to help with post-mortem examinations that unfortunately were required. So again, just acknowledging that 25 years of that tragedy and putting an extract from the original article in the journal for people to have a look at.
Yeah, it was one of the nation's most heinous crimes ever committed, and it really changed the nation in so many ways, especially in terms of gun laws and the nation's attitudes towards firearms.
In some ways, it was almost a case of I really didn't want to mention it, but there was a fair bit of media earlier in the year about the 25 years and such a significant tragic event that we have included a segment of it in the journal.
I think it was the right decision to make. It's important we don't forget key events, and certainly the lessons learnt for investigators from that terrible tragedy were significant and continue to be applied today. Pat, thanks again for making the time to discuss the September anniversary issue, and talk to you next time.
All right, mate, no problem. We keep running.
Wednesday the 3rd of March 2004, the bodies of two women were found bound and floating in a river to the south of Darwin in the Northern Territory. The two women had been born in Thailand. They were Somjai Insamrung and Phrong Sri Kroksamrung. The two were sex workers and they would be reported as missing by concerned friends the day their bodies were found. What followed was an intense police investigation. Although the double homicide was solved relatively quickly, it included an interstate manhunt for the two men who would eventually be convicted of the murders. They were Phu Ngoc Trinh and Ben William McLean. Detective Sergeant Isabel Cummins was part of the investigation team. Today she is attached to the Northern Territory Police's Major Crime Section. Isabel, thanks for your time. The bodies were found in the Adelaide River near a major bridge, about 65 kilometres south of Darwin. How did the grisly find come to police attention?
The bodies were located, one initially, by several people that were on one of the cruise boats, the Adelaide River Jumping Croc Cruisers, and reported to the operator there, who subsequently contacted police.
Where were the bodies actually found?
One of the bodies was located between two of the croc cruise boats and was wedged in between the two of them when they were about to commence a tour. And another body was located approximately 800 metres downstream, floating in the Adelaide River.
So what's the weather like in the top end that time of year?
That time of year is our wet season, so it's very humid. We have some good storms around that period and quite a bit of rain. It's a very busy period. It's not as busy as our dry season, but certainly we do have a lot of tourists that come through and do those tours at that time of year.
What was the initial police response to the call?
When the initial call came in, it was just after 9 o'clock in the morning. Police were dispatched immediately. The initial body that was located was found to be bound and had a car battery tied to a cable tie to the victim's wrists. And obviously it was considered to be suspicious immediately. And our fisheries, marine and fisheries unit were dispatched immediately to that location.
And there was a bit of time between the first body being found and the second?
Yeah, that was about an hour and a half later that one was located, and police were already at the location of the other body at the time, so they were dispatched to the second body, which was found in a very similar condition with a battery tied to it and bound. And it was discovered that there were several items located on the bridge, which indicated that the bodies had been thrown from the bridge.
What were the challenges for police at the crime scene?
Certainly it was a different crime scene for us in that the bodies had to be retrieved from the water as quickly as possible. We didn't know how long they'd been there at that point, but certainly they were both bound and both had the car batteries attached to them, and it looked like they'd been thrown off the Adelaide River Bridge at that point in time. There were a few items that were located on the bridge, being some beads from necklaces and some cable ties, and the women were bound with cable ties, so certainly that was of interest to us. There was some jewellery that was located on the bridge as well.
So what happened then?
So that whole area was sealed off as a crime scene, the length of the bridge there and the areas in which the bodies were located. But that was difficult due to the proximity of the second body, which was downstream from the initial one.
Were there any early leads?
Yeah, there was initially one report of a female who had been missing in the Darwin area. She was somebody who had domestic violence involvements with her partner and had travelled interstate to try and get away from him, and we had received reports of her missing that morning. She was subsequently located safe, and a short time later, about 12:15 that afternoon, two ladies attended the Darwin police station to report two of their friends missing. They were solo operators in the prostitution industry, and the ladies had concerns that they hadn't sighted them for several days and hadn't been able to contact them on their phones, which they usually had on, whether they were working or not.
How long did it take to confirm the identities of the victims?
It didn't take long at all. The descriptions that were provided by the two females and the photos that were provided enabled us to identify the two ladies in the river pretty quickly.
What were the findings from the post-mortem examination?
The post-mortem results showed that the two females had in fact been alive when they were thrown over the bridge. It's possible they were unconscious at the time. They had strangulation marks around their neck, and both of them had some rope tied around their neck at the time they were located, but they had several injuries both of them had received.
What was the early tempo like for the investigation?
Certainly it was pretty busy right from the start. We utilised units from other sections apart from major crime and had a large number of members that were assisting us. We conducted phone inquiries regarding the two victims to identify their last movements, the clientele that they had had in the days and weeks preceding their bodies being located, searches around the area and anybody that lived around there that may have been associated with the two victims, and just general inquiries which were put out to the public through the media to try and ascertain the movements of the victims and any possible suspects.
I understand a local motel became the focal point of the investigation.
Yeah, certainly that's where the ladies resided with their friends and worked out of a lot of the time. So there were a lot of inquiries that were conducted around there, and CCTV that was located of that area and the last time the ladies were seen at that location.
From those checks, a suspect was identified?
Yes, we did. We had several people who had reported seeing an Asian male with the two females, one of the last occasions that they were seen in the afternoon of the 1st of March. And the male was believed to have been driving a white van.
The male's name was Phu Trinh.
Eventually we did locate Trinh's details and the fact that he had access to a white van, which their family used on their okra farm out at Marakai. Some police attended there, and it was just pretty much doing a recce to establish who was in the area. At that time, Trinh was certainly a person of interest, and it was established that Ben McLean was a close associate of his. And during the course of those inquiries, the members got bogged in the property next door, and Trinh and McLean actually approached them and had a conversation with them and sat down with them for a while they waited to get their vehicle out. And it was just general conversation that took place regarding the ladies without direct questioning of them, just to see if they knew about it, and general chit-chat to find out their movements and what they did out there and who they were connected to. And it eventually led to a search warrant being executed at that property the following day. And it was established that both the boys had flown to
Queensland earlier that morning.
Before we talk about what police found at the search warrant, what did you know about Trinh himself?
Trinh was born in South Vietnam and travelled to New Zealand with his family when he was a very young age and went to school there for some time before moving to Australia and Brisbane with his family and subsequently moved to the Northern Territory where his family had the farm out at Marrakech and farmed okra, which is a popular Asian vegetable. And he worked on the farm there a fair bit and had spent some time in Brisbane as well.
Was either Trinh or his friend Ben McLean known to police before this matter?
No, not at all. No, Ben had absolutely no history and Trinh had, I think it was minor driving offences and had not come to police attention that we were aware of.
So what was found at Trinh's house when police executed the search warrant?
There were quite a few items of interest located at the property. Just outside the back door there was an area which had been burnt with a number of items, including some bra wires, some hair clips, a wig with a comb attached, which was found to be linked to Crocs and Rom, so Ponzi. There was also some medication that was located there that belonged to her and a diabetic test kit, and she was known to be a diabetic. So there was quite a few items there.
Was the white van at the house?
The van wasn't there. There was a caravan which had some used condoms and cable ties, some masking tape and some red nylon rope in it, which was found to be the same sort of rope that was used to tie around the victim's necks.
Where did police find the van?
The van was located at McLean's property. A search warrant was executed there and also located some cable ties and some necklace beads, which were found to be the same or similar to what was located on the Adelaide River Bridge and also known to belong to Crocs and Rom.
You said the two men had left the property just a few hours before police arrived. I understand you quickly learned they had flown from the Territory to Brisbane in Queensland. How did you track them down?
We commenced inquiries with Queensland Police and the Homicide Squad there and a number of other units assisted us with tracking the movements of the two offenders once they had arrived in Brisbane. And this was done through phone records and links with known associates of Trinh in particular. Queensland Police attended a number of residents where it was known that the boys had been or been in close proximity.
Did Northern Territory Police travel to Brisbane?
Yeah, two of us attended initially and two further once the boys were actually located there.
I understand McLean's mum tried to help you.
Yeah, she did. She was contacted by us once we had discovered that the van was at the residence and that Ben was believed to be involved, and she established contact.
What did young McLean say to his mum?
He didn't tell her exactly what had happened. He said that he was in a bit of trouble and she tried to get him to cooperate with us and hand himself in, and he refused to do so.
So in a late night raid, police found the two men in suburban Brisbane.
Yeah, they were located hiding in a cupboard at a residence in Stretton in Brisbane, and it was a fella that Ben had played basketball with at school, whose residence it was, so it was just a friend that he'd contacted to go and stay with, and they had no idea of what had happened in the Northern Territory.
What was the demeanour of the two suspects?
They were very nervous. Certainly there were quite a number of police there at the time when they were located, and it was late at night, it was almost midnight when they were located. So it was a bit of a shock to them, I think, and certainly a big shock to the family that they were staying with there as the young friend and his parents. So, yeah, quite overwhelming for them, I'd say, with the police presence, and they were obviously separated and spoken to by Queensland Police initially at the scene.
What did they say at the time?
They both spoke to Queensland Police and provided varying accounts of what had occurred. Ben McLean initially indicated that it was a drug debt that was owed to an outlaw motorcycle gang, and that he had driven the van and Trinh had in fact killed both the ladies in the back of the van. Trinh admitted to hiring the prostitute and said that they were collected by a driver. He indicated he wasn't involved in any deaths and they just fled the Northern Territory because of fear after they saw what had happened to the ladies.
What happened back at the police station?
They both conducted interviews with myself and other Queensland Police members. Trinh indicated that he was ticked off at something and had killed the ladies for that reason. He downplayed McLean's involvement in it. McLean took part in an interview as well and indicated a similar story to what he had told police on initial attendance at the house, in that he was owing money to an outlaw motorcycle gang and had paid his debt off by killing the ladies.
Were there any issues in extraditing the two from Queensland to the Northern Territory?
No, there wasn't. We sought search warrants, which were subsequently executed by Queensland Police, and they went to court and the extradition proceedings took place, and they were remanded into our custody to bring them back to the Northern Territory.
I understand there was some paperwork found linking Trin to some items used in the murders.
Yeah, that's correct. Trin, prior to attending at the hotel where he picked up the ladies, had attended Super Cheap Autos at one of the suburbs just outside of Darwin City, and he had located cable ties and some rope and some tape, and a receipt was located in his wallet for those items, which he paid cash for at the time.
The trial for the two occurred in February and March 2005, 2 years after the murders. I read that the stories of the two men had evolved a tad since they spoke to you on the night of their arrest.
Yeah, certainly they did evolve. They were quite fanciful, the stories that came up in their evidence in court. Trin had stated that a Vietnamese gang had actually attended his residence and he'd witnessed but didn't participate in the murders. He had been with them. He said that he'd been threatened with a gun by them as well. McLean also said that a Vietnamese gang was involved, or some Vietnamese men had attended Trin's place, and that he had been transported in the van along with the others, and then he'd been told to get out of the van approximately 4 kilometres down the road from Trin's residence by Trin, and he said he got out and stayed on the side of the road for several hours, and then Trin came back and picked him up.
It took a while for the jury to reach a guilty verdict?
It did take some time, but certainly I don't think they had any doubt regarding the guilty verdict. Certainly there was a lot of evidence that they had to consider and take their time to consider. They certainly didn't believe the fanciful story that they had come up with in their evidence.
A lengthy prison sentence was imposed by the trial judge.
Yeah, they were both sentenced to 25 years. We have mandatory sentencing in the Northern Territory, so it's for murder it's 20 years, and aggravations means that it's 25 year at least. So the aggravation being the two victims.
Have either of the two provided police with any additional information since their sentences, explaining why they did what they did or what actually occurred?
They certainly haven't provided any other information to us regarding what has occurred or the reasons for it occurring. From what we can ascertain, it just seems like a bit of a thrill kill, and certainly Trin had some level of premeditation in purchasing the items that he purchased that afternoon. It's not known if McLean knew that the ladies were actually being brought out to the residence, as Trin was on his own when he picked them up.
Upon reflection, what were some of the lessons that police learnt about the investigation procedures into this job?
An investigation of this magnitude, we always learn something from with our debriefs and speaking to the members involved. We did have a lack of experienced resources for something of this magnitude, and a lot of members that weren't familiar with our major crime management plan that we utilise for jobs of this scale, and a lot of miscommunication between different people from different areas, and the fact that we had to utilise resources from so many different areas. The operations room that we utilised wasn't quite suitable for this, and certainly workloads for some of the individual members and units like our forensics section. It raised a lot of awareness of making sure that we keep them in the loop with everything that we're doing and vice versa. But generally, overall, it was quite a successful investigation, obviously, with the results.
Isabel, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
That was Detective Sergeant Isabel Cummins of the Northern Territory Police. Her article, The Murders of Somjai Insarung and Phrung Sri Kroksamrong, was initially published in the June 2008 issue of the APJ and has been reprinted in the 75th anniversary issue. Well, that's all for this episode. I'd like to thank Isabel Cummins and Pat Perroz for their time. As always, when we discuss crime cases, our respects and thoughts go out to the victims and their families, and to police and others who are able to bring the offenders to justice. Irrespective of whether you are or aren't a subscriber, why not check out our website at apjl.com.au. At the site are some of our free-to-read articles, our podcasts, and the subscriber-only sections. Subscribers have exclusive online access to over 160 past issues of the journal, with more historical copies being uploaded each month. You can take out a subscription either through the website or by contacting our wonderful staff at the APJ office on 02 9285 3399. Until next time, take care.